So we're starting Christians in the State today. So there's a handout here. Let me read through the introduction here. We'll have some kind of discussion questions to get started. So in his Templeton Prize address, Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, "Over half a century ago, while I was still a child, I recall hearing a number of older people offer the following explanation for the great disasters that had befallen Russia. Men have forgotten God, that's why all this has happened. Since then, I've spent well nigh 50 years working on the history of our revolution. In the process, I've read hundreds of books, collected hundreds of personal testimonies, and have already contributed 8 volumes of my own toward the effort of clearing away the rubble left by the upheaval. But if I were asked today to formulate as concisely as possible the main cause of our ruinous revolution that swallowed up some 60 million of our people, I could not put it more accurately than to repeat, men have forgotten God, that's why all this has happened." Yeah. So Solzhenitsyn was in the Soviet, in Russia, and wrote quite a bit, history and philosophy, kind of reflecting on that. So his basic analysis is that, you know, these evils in the government happen because men have forgotten God. And so I guess the question is, why do you think that is true? Why do you think that we drift towards this totalitarianism that happens in different governmental systems when the systems forget about God's leadership?
Stupidity.
Just got released maybe a month ago, and he "Live Not by Lies" is actually a quote by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Basically, his argument is that what happened in pre-Soviet Russia is what's happening today, and how totalitarianism is basically the fruit of godlessness. Mm-hmm. That when people forget about God, they start to, you know, they have this internal desire to worship, and that in turn can be, you know, drive people to worship the state and whatever utopia the state might bring. Yeah. And so, fascinating book, by the way. Recommendation: "Live Not by Lies" by Rod Dreher, Dreher.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was interesting that, you know, I was doing some reading, and I've heard personally from a non-Christian one time in conversation, I read this from another person commenting on the seeking out the leadership, is they said, what we need is like a benevolent dictator, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Someone who cares about us all but has all the power to do what's necessary. And that it seems like what you're saying, there's a replacement. They need a God. And if there's no God, then the government is the closest.
And really, throughout history, I mean, time, place doesn't matter. There is always a God figure in everyone's mm-hmm. life. And mm-hmm. often, the God figure is the totalitarian ruler. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's just this, who is the highest authority around? We worship that mm-hmm. highest authority. When you remove God, what is the next highest authority that can unite us, that can control us, that can be efficient? Like, all those things. Mm-hmm. The next best right. option is a state, and there's always plenty of people willing to be part of that of totalitarian system. Mm-hmm. Claim moral high ground and impose that on everyone else.
Yeah. Yeah. Pharaoh was worshipped as a god. Yeah. Caesar was worshipped as a god.
I mean, throughout Asia, yeah. emperors mm-hmm. have always been worshipped as gods. It's just very common.
Yeah. And I think that we, many times, maybe not, people may take all the same actions and still deny that, right? So they're worshiping someone as their God, even though they would say, oh, no, they're not.
Yeah.
Right? They're not my God. And so then I guess that one of the questions is, so what we're kind of going to try and get to, right? So how should we act in relationship to government? So should Christians work to wed the church and the state in an attempt to guarantee, right? Can we do something in our legal system, our governmental system, or should we, to try and prevent that? What is that? What do you think?
We have something, the Constitution.
Constitution?
I don't know. The Constitution stands for everything that a Christian stands for.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
It would be foolish not to try to make an effort.
Mm-hmm. What is it, if I could dig a little, what is it about the Constitution that you guys think that's particularly, because there's so many things that are, that we're thankful for in the Constitution. So what are the particular things that maybe help protect or to try and allow us to remember God or not to forget God?
We just take the Bill of Rights and apply that, you know, and look in the Bible about how you should treat your neighbor,
mm-hmm.
and how you should act with others. And it's mm-hmm. basically along the same lines and even more in depth at times. But I think the Bill of Rights is the most important piece of anything that we've attempted to do. And so the Constitution is a great piece of work. It gets, you know, it gets very complicated at times.
Yeah, it does.
So, but we're supposed to be a Christian government. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't always work that way.
I think the framers of the Constitution acknowledged that it was imperfect, highly imperfect, mm-hmm. in fact, kind of grotesque.
Mm-hmm.
Certain people are worth 3/5 of a human, but they don't have any say in anything that happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's grotesque distortions in the original Constitution. Mm-hmm. It was hideous. The framers acknowledged that from different sides for different reasons. They built into it ways that we could improve it. So I think what we have today is better than it was before, but it's only better because it keeps the government out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
So that a liberal society, we're part of a long train of liberal societies in the West, starting in the Enlightenment, we can maintain a liberal society which basically keeps people out of each other's way, mm-hmm. so that we can believe and worship mm-hmm. in ways that we're going to, that we want to. Mm-hmm. The Constitution does nothing to promote a memory of God. It mm-hmm. does everything to allow it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why when we see the erosion of allowing one another to think and believe what we want. Mm-hmm. That's where we should all be very concerned.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good.
I think, what are you doing that day?
Oh, I was just saying, when you compare, let's say, England,
mm-hmm.
most of the persecution of Christians was because of the state church.
Mm-hmm.
And during the Marian persecution, the state church switched from being Anglican to being Catholic, and mandated force
mm-hmm.
conversions, and even the, you know, the Pilgrims and the Puritans, I mean, they were nonconformists. They would not worship according to the state-sanctioned liturgy. Mm-hmm. And so it is interesting how all these state churches in Europe, you look at where, you know, the spiritual state there versus the U.S., part mm-hmm. of it is because the Constitution is kind of built on the concept that absolute power corrupts absolutely. You know, mm-hmm. there's checks and balances.
Yeah.
You know, one branch doesn't hold sway over mm-hmm. the other. It is to kind of get out of
right.
the way. So I think in that sense it was is a Christian document in the sense that it understands human nature
mm-hmm.
and the effect of power on human nature and a proclivity towards mm-hmm. grasping for it and wanting it and trying mm-hmm. to impose it on others.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that one thing that we're going to talk about is both with biblically, you know, there are things which we are commanded to do and there's things which we have a freedom in. And then when we think about government, there's things that we're legally obligated to do and by the government, and then there's places where the government gives us freedom. And so to maintain and understand those distinctions, do we want the government to obligate all citizens to do something, or do we want them to have the freedom to make their own exercise and choice, which is preferable in those cases. And I think, like Reader's saying, it's often preferable to remove, the more obligation we remove from the government, right, the Constitution, the more freedom we would have to make those choices.
Which is why, like Ellen said, the Bill of Rights is the most beautiful part of all of it. Because
right.
that's basically the government cannot mm-hmm. do these things to you.
Yeah. And it's based, you know, the fact that it's rooted in, it's not based on the majority granted, it's inalienable to us as individuals. So any general principles you think, what's a good, you guys have a good, or like how should a Christian, if you're a Christian, what's specific in terms of how we should relate to the government, whether that's state government, city, local, county, federal, all those things. What are some principles that you think are valuable?
You gotta pay your taxes whether you like it or not.
Oh yeah, you gotta pay your taxes. We're gonna get to that. That's definitely scriptural.
Yep.
Pull over when the flashing lights in the rearview mirror.
That's right. Pull over when you don't run from the car.
I think it's great in our country, though, every citizen has an obligation, I think, to vote, even though we vote differently, probably. Mm-hmm. But it's an opportunity we have that we feel that gives us a chance to have a say,
yeah.
even on an individual level.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a freedom that we have that is not in a lot of places.
Yeah.
And we think it makes
very
a difference.
Rare.
We feel like
yeah.
it makes a difference.
It does.
And so,
yeah,
I think it does.
Yeah. So many of those
systems imperfect.
Those things that we have so many pieces of the government that are elected with term limits. So you always have a chance to voice and remove, and people can be removed and brought in. Or they can stay oftentimes, you know, sometimes.
And even down to the local level, you know, if I, well, like the way my road looks, I can go find somebody that's
right.
supposed to be responsible.
Talk to them, yeah. That's it.
You have a say anyway. You know?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's kind of one of our focuses. We'll be talking about how to be involved and what ways to best be involved in the government and at what level, so how much, and then how to do that specifically is kind of what we're talking about. So I think we will acknowledge kind of here in the second paragraph on the first page is that we're kind of living in two worlds in a sense. We know that Jesus talked about that his kingdom is not of this world. So we're citizens of this heavenly kingdom, but we're also residents on earth. And so how we should relate, kind of at the bottom of the first page, right? Some Christians, from a post-millennial perspective, right, they believe that we're in the 1,000-year reign of Christ, and things should be conforming more and more and more to Christ's leadership, his rule over the planet on earth here and now. Would say that we would Christianize the world to prepare for the return of Christ. The saints must prepare to take over the world's government and its courts. So that kind of perspective is Christ's rule should be reigning in every facet through the courts, the legislature, the leadership of all the governments. And then other Christians from premillennial, believing that we're not in the 1,000-year reign of Christ, but we are in a time where we're going through the church age and the trials. Perspective believe that this political transformation can only occur when Jesus returns. So it can lead to some extreme positions. There's a quote here from Norman Geisler, a famous contemporary premillennial evangelist, quips, "He has no time to clean up the cesspool because he's too busy fishing for souls in it." So these two examples illustrate kind of some extreme positions. Right, being extremely politically active or inactive. And so that's what our goal is to kind of inform from the scriptures, instruct, and clarify how we can maintain our citizenship both here on earth and heaven. And I think one thing that Chris and I had a good talk about was there's a question of how much we should be involved in the political process. And then there's also kind of an underlying question of in what way do we get involved with the political process? So like you're talking about, if there's something that you don't agree with in your local area, do you call a certain person? Do you vote a certain way? Do you form a petition? Do you form a group? There's lots of different ways in which we can seek to be involved in the political process and in the governing authorities. Do you run for that position yourself, right? Mm-hmm. There's many different ways there in which we can be involved. Okay, so let's get into kind of have some discussion. So a couple things about Scripture as we get ready. So we talked about this with the Old Testament before, right? But the Old Testament civil statutes, they don't apply to us today, right? The Mosaic Law Code it's wonderful and educational, but God designed it for that specific people at a specific time. So I like how they wrote in here, it's on hold, right? It's not that it's at an end, right? Christ is going to return and reign as an absolute monarch. The benevolent dictator will happen eventually. But in between, right, we're looking to decide what and to figure out what we should be doing in this time period between. Okay, so let's read the first passage here. So this is one, right? This is going to hit the taxes and maybe a couple other things. So Matthew 22, 17 through 22, or actually 15 through 22, we can look at. So Pharisees are laying this trap, asking him if they should pay taxes to Caesar. If he says yes, he's going to be unpopular with the Jewish nationalists because they don't want to be subjected to Rome. And negative would say, no, we're not. If we don't pay taxes, then they could charge him with treason. So they thought, you know, it's a lose-lose situation. And so he asked them to show them a coin. It's like the Lincoln pennies had the image of Caesar on there. The Jews considered this to be blasphemous, for it was a graven image, paying homage to someone other. So here's how I respond. So someone want to read there that passage from Matthew.
Says, tell us then, what do you think? Is it lawful to give a poll tax to Caesar or not? But Jesus perceived their malice and said, why are you testing me, you hypocrites? Show me the coin used for the poll tax. And they brought him a denarius. And he said to them, whose likeness and inscription is this? They said to him, Caesar's. Then he said to them, then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And hearing this, they were amazed, and leaving him, they went away.
Yeah. Okay, so let's summarize. What was his answer? What did he say to them? Should they pay taxes or not? Yes. And did he just say, he didn't just say yes, he said, and give him a bonus, right?
Whatever things are in.
And to God the things that are
God. Yeah, to God the things that are God. So he's saying you can do both at the same time, mm-hmm. right? You can render to Caesar some things that are his, and you can still render to God the things that are God. So he's not saying it's an either or. Right. If I pay taxes to Caesar, then I'm disobeying God. Or if I don't pay taxes, then I'm obeying God. So we can do both. And at first, I would say one thing I noticed that was interesting is that word render. It's like it's like a repay, like pay something that's due, right? It's not like you go in and donate something. It's like it's used to repay someone, right? If someone's done you evil, repay them with good. And so it's this idea that the government is serving a purpose and we are repaying them. We're paying a debt that is owed them, right? And so I think there's another passage where that term is used, where it's whether taxes or customs or whatever that we'll see. And I think, you know, it's nice to think about the symbolism too, that, you know, when he says whose face is an inscription is on it, to point out that belongs to Caesar, right? What's the connection between that command, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and then what are we to render to God?
Ourselves.
Yeah, because we're the image bearer. Right? That's right. So the taxes, that's Caesar's, but we, as individuals, are belonging to God. Okay, let's go ahead and go down to John 19. Let's go to another scripture. John 19, 10, 11. So this is his interchange with Pilate. Someone want to read that?
So Pilate said to him, "You do not speak to me. Do you not know that I have authority to release you and I have authority to crucify you?" Jesus answered, "You would have no authority over me unless it has been given you from above. For this reason, he who delivered me to you has the greater sin."
So what do we learn about Pilate's authority from the words of Jesus?
God gave him the authority to order Jesus' death and all the other things he's doing.
Mm-hmm. How did Jesus respond to that authority that was given? Did he no, I'm not going to go along with that. It's kind of an interesting observation because God gave him the authority to do this. Now, were Pilate's actions good or evil? Condemning Jesus to die and handing him over.
Evil.
Yeah, right. So even though we see that even though God gave him the authority, that doesn't mean that he's that person that's given the authority is going to act in a righteous way.
Right.
Right. And then how did God use Pilate's actions? For good or for evil? For good, right? So it's an interesting kind of ethical question where God ordains these men to act in certain places and times, and they are exercising the authority that God gave, and many times they're working out of their own evil intentions and making very evil actions. But God is ultimately sovereignly in control of those things, bringing about his plan and his will. So we see Jesus acknowledging that, revealing that, and submitting to that structure.
Kind of hung up a little bit on the last part of that, where he says, "For this reason, he who delivered me to you has the greater sin."
Mm-hmm.
Greater sin than Pilate. So, why would that be?
Well, let's see. Who is it that delivered him over?
Okay.
Yeah, so the high priest or the rulers of the Jews?
Which was a Jew, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So he's saying his sin is greater than Pilate's sin here, right? Why would we think that is?
That's my question.
Oh, okay. That was my Dave Orley move. Why do you think that is?
Because he should have known who Jesus was.
Yeah. With greater knowledge and greater rejection of God's truth, there's greater accountability. Pilate was kind of, are you the king? Who are you? Right?
Pilate's making a political calculation, like, okay, I'm appeasing these people, please Rome.
Yeah.
And Caiaphas had years of knowledge of who Jesus was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And all the scriptures.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to, this is a key text that we'll get a lot of things from. So Romans 13. So anytime we think about government and Christian's role to government, this is a good passage. Okay, and just a little preface, right? A little history, context, background, right? It was written to who?
The
Romans, right? The church in Rome, who was under what government?
Nero,
right? So that's the context of the government. What he's talking about when he wrote this. He's writing to the leaders there. So if someone wants to read here, right? So this also in the previous chapters, Paul was describing the new life of the Christian, and now he's giving a lot of implications. What does that mean? Based on who you are in Christ, what Christ has done for you, how should you live? And so this is a portion that talks about how they should relate to the government. Okay, so someone want to read a little passage, seven verses here, 13, 1 through 7.
I can do that.
Okay.
"Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, For there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Therefore, it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor.
That's great. Yeah. Thinking, Seth?
No, I'm trying to.
You had this look for a second. I was like, I don't know. So, just looking at the first couple verses, right? What is our basic responsibility to in relation to the government, and why?
Obedience, obey them, be subject to them, because God submits.
Yeah. So submit to them is our main verb there, what we should do, and then because they've been ordained by God. And then what are its functions? So this is where we start to think about what kind of government, right, or what should we think about when we think about the role of government. So verses 3 and 4, right, what purpose does the government have in this context for sure?
In general, they bring social order. I mean, I look at the alternative, anarchy,
mm-hmm.
right? If you go to a failed state of Somalia, you wish you had a government there.
Mm-hmm.
Because might make right in that kind of environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it says we're supposed to be afraid of doing evil. The government makes us afraid of doing evil. And that's, I mean, I want people to be afraid of doing evil.
Mm-hmm.
We all do, right?
Yeah.
So that's what it's supposed to be.
Yeah, so it's not only does it punish evil, but it also mitigates the amount of evil because of that punishment. It discourages people. So someone murders, they receive punishment, and it also prevents more murdering because of the punishment that the government administers. And, you know, it kind of says in there as well, they're not a cause of fear for good behavior. So in a sense, and he also says, do what is good and you'll have praise from the same. So in a sense, it's not just the negative aspect that he's talking about. Government ought to not only punish evil, but ought to somehow reward or hold up some sort of standard for what is right, good.
Mm-hmm.
Don't murder, don't steal. Right? And then there's an additional, right? Not just because of the fear of punishment, but what other is the motivation in verse 5?
Conscience.
Yeah, for your conscience sake, right? So you wouldn't want to violate your conscience by disobeying the government.
It's interesting that it's a minister of God.
Mm-hmm.
An avenger, right? Vengeance is God's.
Mm-hmm.
And the government is one of the ways that he
meets out justice.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is obviously an ideal.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always that
mm-hmm.
way, but that is what government is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And almost every government to some level is going to do that.
Yeah. And we talked about this in a sense when we were talking about like when we talked about abortion and euthanasia and just the idea of murder and why murder is wrong and taking the life of an immigrant, and the difference between an individual seeking out vengeance, right, versus a the government or the institution of government. And I think it's interesting too, the pronouns here are it, right? So he's referring to the institution of government. He doesn't say specifically, although, you know, by implication, the person who is the Caesar, but he doesn't say Nero, right? He doesn't use the name of a specific individual. That is, this is the god that you should obey. It's whoever is in that position of a governing authority.
Yeah. And it's interesting with Paul. I mean, one thing that you see in his journeys throughout Acts is how much he interacts with the government.
Mm-hmm.
Where the Roman soldiers tried to quell a riot, right? They wanted law and order. Because he's a Roman citizen, they wanted a just and fair trial.
Mm-hmm.
There was an order to things to kind of even stop vigilantes from just lynching him. And so, as you know, Paul, I think, probably had an appreciation for mm-hmm. how he trusted the government more than the Jewish state, and the government protected him from mm-hmm. many of his adversaries.
And he used the government to accomplish the gospel purposes.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he appealed to Caesar so he could go to Rome. He used his appeals process.
Yeah.
And he talks about how his arrest has served to advance the kingdom, that he's been sharing the gospel. Mm-hmm. And so although he wasn't saying that the government has acted justly, he used it to the advantage of spreading the gospel in the kingdom. Even understanding that that may involve him being arrested for spreading the gospel.
So today he trusted the Roman government more than the Jewish government.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, and in a sense, they were... it's like what we talked about at the beginning. Would we prefer the government be mandating, requiring we should all practice Christianity, or be somewhat open to allow us to choose that, right? In this sense, the Romans weren't as antagonistic as the Pharisees and the Jews were in terms of this is what you must believe, this is what you must practice.
We see that today, even right now, with a bunch of the COVID restrictions. Like, the anger comes from the micromanaging that mm-hmm. the government is doing on mm-hmm. the people, I feel mm-hmm. like.
Mm-hmm. True. Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely a sense in which, like we talked about, there's a tendency to acquire power from just as any individual, whatever position you're in. And in government, there's always this tendency to want to acquire more. So one of the good things that we hopefully have continued to benefit from is the attempt to separate and to parse that power out to as many places as possible.
That's the problem. Power corrupts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. More power. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's funny because many people I talk to will talk about the corruption, but there's a lack of sometimes understanding that it can corrupt anyone. So there's sometimes a belief that it's a certain kind of person, you know, private individuals are corrupt by their power, but somehow government officials are not corrupted by their power. And so
pastors of very large churches can become corrupt.
Yeah, any kind of power can.
Very small ones.
Yeah, yeah. It's true. It's true. It's kind of like what we talked about. You don't have to be rich to be greedy. You don't have to have a lot of power to be power hungry. Very true. So some of the main points from that passage we need to remember is that government has been established by God. The function is to dispense justice to evildoers. And our obedience must go beyond just fear of punishment, that we ought to obey out of conscience sake, that we know it's the right thing to do, that God has commanded us to love him and to love others by submitting to the government that has been placed over us. And also, right, Alan's point, rulers serve God and deserve to be remunerated, is that right? I don't use that word often, with taxes, customs, fear, and honor. When I used to read this, I'm like, what customs? Well, that's a type of tax. It's another type of tax. So, got to pay our taxes.
That used to be how the U.S. financed itself, was through customs. They put a custom on every import. That's how the federal government was. We still do. We just don't see it as much.
Right. And I think we don't want to just skip over. We don't want to skip over that because, I mean, taxes, it's a big place where Christians can be disobedient. If we cheat on our taxes or don't submit all our taxes, don't pay our taxes.
We pay a lot of taxes. I mean, you look at sales tax, property tax, federal tax, state tax. I mean,
gas tax,
capital gains.
And we're not even in
income tax on our cars.
Payroll tax.
Tax.
And we don't even live in Texifornia.
Right?
Yeah.
So it could be even worse. Oh my goodness. I was going to do some research. I did to see like what it would have been like in those days. So for the Jews living under the Romans, how much they would be taxed. Maybe we'll see if we can find. I don't know if we can find out or not. But.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to look at.
Pre-Rome, it was close to 30%. Would be what they would pay, so.
Under the monarchy.
And, during the Roman Empire, to be tax-free, I mean, there are certain offices that gave you a tax exemption.
Mm-hmm.
That gave you this huge advantage.
Right.
Because they lived hand-in-hand back then, so 30% tax is pretty significant. And that's honestly one of the reasons why the exile came upon them is they were supposed to leave their land fallow every 7 years. And so that was kind of government regulation.
Right.
And because they did not do it, God took the land away from them for 70 years.
The tax man came.
Yeah.
He got audited.
Right.
That's an expensive audit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's look at maybe one more. So let's look at 1 Timothy 2. 1-3. If somebody wants to read that.
First of all, then, I urge that entreaties and prayers, petitions and thanksgivings be made on behalf of all men, for kings and all who are in authority, so that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. This is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior.
All right. So who are we supposed to pray for? Here. We're being commanded. Are urged.
All in authority.
Soon will be President Biden and Vice President Harris.
And those are specific ones he's pointing out because it says he says on behalf of all men and then specifically for kings and all who are in authority. So we're praying not just for those leaders but for our nation, for the fellow citizens in our city, our state, our country. It's the same word when it says made on behalf of all men, and then for kings. It's that's the same word. So you could say on behalf of all men, on behalf of kings and all who are in authority. So he's saying pray for everyone, pray for the nation, pray for all people, and specifically pray for the kings and those. Like almost like don't forget or focus in on these. And why? Why would it be? Why does he kind of say it'd be good to pray for them? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a purpose, like he gives you kind of a prayer prompt. So start out praying for this, right? Pray for this. And why might it be, other than just the obvious, we want to have peace and quiet, right? Why might that also be a part of God's plan? How can that help us? I think they said, how can our government help us to preach, proclaim, and live the gospel? And you could think about the opposite. If we didn't have peace, if we were in civil unrest and war, how would that hinder our ability?
I mean, I look at this COVID pandemic right now, and that's not what I've been thinking about is how easy it is to be self-focused, not only as a person, but as a church, where we're doing what we can to make sure that the church survives. I think in any times of crisis or persecution, that's your number one thought is survival, not necessarily expansion. You only live long enough to expand. But I think in times of tranquility, it's easier to think about how to reach out. And you don't feel like your existence is threatened.
This really reminded me, one year at Ironman, Brett had a, someone from this former, I don't know if it was Ukraine, someone had been to the, some time, he came in and spoke at one of the breakout sessions, and we were talking, and he was talking about just the persecution of the church, and living under those times, and then there was a mention of, you know, the blessings of the freedoms we have here, and he kind of talked about it like, how if you have only prosperity, it's like sitting on the couch just getting fat and like everything feels good, but you're not, you're weak. If you have only persecution, you get beaten down and you don't have a time, right? So he talked about how there's a balance where God has times where the church is persecuted, you know, and it is, many good things can come from that. There's a purification that can come from that. There's a spreading out, like in the dispersion, when the Christians were persecuted, they had to leave and spread out. And then there's a time of this peace and tranquility, which allows them to rebuild. Like in my, we often talk about with the kids at school with their learning. I'm like, it's like your muscles. They have to get stressed first, broken down, and then you need to have the time to recover and rebuild stronger. And so I think when we pray, we're praying that the leaders would give us that peaceful time to grow, to spread the gospel. But we also have to be ready and know that there are going to be time. It's not always going to be peaceful and calm in all parts of the world for the church everywhere. And so to be prepared for those times, trusting in God during those times as well.
It is really interesting. I've never thought of it before that that's the same word that we're praying for all men and for women,
right.
Basically. Because today a lot of what's hindering us in our freedoms is not necessarily just the government. It's other institutions. It's mm-hmm. universities. Mm-hmm. It's professors. It's businesses. Mm-hmm. It's bosses. And there are circumstances that are more conducive to gospel spread than others. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went to the University of California. I went to UCLA. And was saved there mm-hmm. in Campus Crusade. And it was during a time when it was encouraged that we share our ideas. And mm-hmm. truth is out there, and we all want to find it. Mm-hmm. And so free exchange of ideas was greatly encouraged everywhere. Mm-hmm. Every class, everywhere. Today, you cannot open your mouth and say the things that got me saved mm-hmm. when I was a student mm-hmm. there. They've kicked the campus groups off campus. They can't meet there. They can't recruit there. They can't be part of the student groups. They're not funded. You know, you can't stand up and say things in class and expect to pass the class. You can't get tenure there unless you take a loyalty oath mm-hmm. in any of the UC system. Those are things that hinder the spread of the gospel. And so when we're praying, what are the kinds of things we're praying for? We're praying for the Bill of Rights everywhere, right? Get out of the way mm-hmm. so that people can seek the truth and find the Lord. Mm-hmm. And so that people can share the gospel freely. I mean, those are the circumstances we want in every workplace, mm-hmm. in every school, home, everywhere.
Right.
Whether it's from the government or from other people with any level of authority.
And it's a good point to mention that there's not just, government is not the only source of power. And anywhere there's a godlessness that creates that vacuum. And at the university level, that's definitely something that's taken up. But when you remove God as the ultimate authority, then the majority opinion becomes the ruling.
Yes. I have a look at our high school. Now they don't allow youth pastors to have lunch with the kids.
It's crazy.
You know, and then growing up, that was acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But even a slight policy change like that discourages spiritual curiosity
yeah.
parts of the student.
Yeah, I've heard the sociologist talk about how the universities have always had a liberal imbalance, so it might have been 8-1, 10-1, and now it's maybe like 30-1, and in the sense that it used to be that everyone knew somebody
yeah.
that was a conservative or had this different viewpoint, and they would person would like fire it when they would say something just totally crazy, and say, well, you know, and they would kind of compare and see what. And now there's no voice in many of those places to say, this seems crazy, or, you know.
Isn't that kind of thing going to precipitate a crisis at some point? And I think, you know, in crisis is where people seek the Lord,
mm-hmm.
that have avoided him and even you know, diminished him in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's like that original, right? When men forget God, you know, the society, the government, it continues to deteriorate to this.
Yeah. We who are believers should be expecting a crisis, I think, at some point. Well, what's coming?
And just knowing that it's, knowing that it will become increasingly difficult. So, for me to talk to my coworkers and to talk to my students about the gospel, either one takes very specific planning, or two, just a willingness to accept if there's some sort of discipline taken.
But you know, the ones who have preached the hardest against Christianity, you know, let's take California. When the lights go out and the food's not there, things change pretty quickly.
It does. Yeah, it does. And I think there's one sense in which one of the things is, like Solzhenitsyn said something like, can a warm man understand a freezing man? Mm-hmm. Like, it's hard for us, many of the people who are tearing down kind of our system of government, to really understand what they're working towards, because they're experiencing the benefits of living under those freedoms. And so for many people, right, that they have to
hit the bottom,
right? And so it's very hard to actually, you know, what is the best way? Can we change their mind without hitting the bottom? Let's see where we're at here. Let's read one more passage. We got time. 1 Peter chapter 2, 13 through 17. So Peter's explaining how believers are to live in this world that rejects the message of the gospel. He says, "Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority, or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, and the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Act as free men, and do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as bondslaves of God. Honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, and honor the king." Okay. So, in this gives it another reminder, much like what Paul says, we're to submit to the governing authority. What's his motivation in verse 1? For the Lord's sake. So we're doing this as a service to the Lord. And then he kind of reiterates what we talked about earlier, verse 14. What's the function? What is the purpose of those governing authorities?
Punish the evildoers.
Mm-hmm. To punish the evildoers. And the praise of those who do right. Right? Punish evil, reward good. And he gives a different rationale, I guess, than before. What kind of accusations would our obedience to the government silence? So if we're obedient to government, what does that prevent people from saying? What did they say about Paul when there were a lot of those? This guy's stirring up riots. He's turning everything upside down. He's telling us to rebel. Same thing. They tried to get Jesus. Treason. They're causing rebellion. Right? So it's kind of a common theme to say these Christians are rebelling. And in many times, I wonder, in their eyes, if you're not worshiping, and so if your Lord is and your God is not just the highest authority of man, it sometimes
patriotic.
Right. It seems to them this person's not on our team in a sense. Like they're not loyal to the party.
Can't trust him.
Yeah. Yeah. And how would you say the submission to your government would demonstrate love to your neighbors? How does that work out?
You know, I think of submission as having to do something you don't want to do or do something you don't believe in. But it can be less than that. It can be just paying your taxes.
Yeah.
And so,
Hopefully, if Carissa's submissive, it's not just that she's always doing something she disagrees with and doesn't want to do, right?
Yeah.
often submission can be joyful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my point. That's what I tried to
that's,
say.
I thought that's what you meant.
Yeah. I think that's the thing. Like, if we all agree that the government is here for everyone's good, then I'm loving my neighbor by supporting the government that's there for their good. Mm-hmm. By paying my taxes, my gas taxes or whatever, to keep mm-hmm. good roads for my neighbor as well as for me. And funding
yeah,
the police.
The police force.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a selfless act. You're paying for the service that not just serves you, but serves all the citizens that are under the rule of the government. Okay. Well, that's good. We got New Testament basically enjoins Christians to submit to the powers that be and promote a tranquil and peaceful society. So this serenity will help Christians pursue the goals of the church, spiritual growth, spread of the gospel. So as we'll find out, obedience doesn't mandate we ignore God or remain silent. So when we start next time, we'll talk about Christians and political engagement. So I think good question for you to think about between this Sunday and next Sunday is kind of two-parted. You know, we had that quote at the beginning. There's one that says we need to take over everything, right? Christians dominate courts, legislature. And there's a person on the other end that's saying, I can't clean any of this up. You know, I'm just going to try and save souls. I'm not worried about any of the government. So think about where you are on that spectrum. What do you think your engagement should be with the government? How can you engage with the government or the political system that we're in? What would be the Christian's role? And that's kind of where we'll start.